This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that militants in the Gaza Strip will pay a very heavy price after a day of Gaza rocket fire and Israeli airstrikes on the Palestinian coastal enclave. Hostilities between Israel and Hamas escalated again, raising the death toll in 2 days to at least 30 Palestinians and 3 Israelis, with Israel carrying out multiple airstrikes in Gaza and the Islamist militant group firing rockets at Tel Aviv. In one case, a 13-story residential Gaza block collapsed after one of several dozen airstrikes. Late into the night, the residents reported their homes shaking and the sky lighting up with near-constant Israeli strikes. More than 1,000 gas stations in the U.S. Southeast are reporting running out of fuel, primarily because of what analysts say is unwarranted panic buying among drivers, as a shutdown of a major pipeline by a gang of hackers entered its fifth day Tuesday. Government officials acted swiftly to waive safety and environmental rules to speed the delivery of fuel by truck, ship, or rail to motorists and airports. This is even after they sought to assure the public that there was no cause for alarm. The Colonial Pipeline, which is the biggest fuel pipeline in the U.S., delivers about 45% of what is consumed on the U.S. East Coast. It was hit Friday with a cyber attack by hackers who lock up computer systems and demand a ransom to release them. It raised concerns about the vulnerability of the nation's critical infrastructure. This is VOA News. Murder indictments against a man accused of killing 8 people, mainly Asian Americans, in the Atlanta area. We get more from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
Grand juries in Fulton and Cherokee counties, Georgia, have indicted Robert Aaron Long on murder charges for a series of shootings at massage businesses in the Atlanta area on March 16th. Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis wants a capital trial.
I, along with my staff, have made a determination that this office will seek the death penalty.
The grand jury in Cherokee County has leveled 23 charges against the 22-year-old Long. He faces 19 counts in Fulton County. 6 of the 8 victims were women of Asian descent. Willis adds that she is also seeking hate crime charges against Long. There's no word on when Long will be arraigned in either county. I'm Tim McGuire.
A Texas judge has dismissed bankruptcy filings by the National Rifle Association, disrupting the group's plan to relocate to the state of Texas. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Federal Judge Harlan Hale says he's dismissing the NRA's bankruptcy case after 11 days of testimony because he believes it was not filed in good faith. Judge Hale writes, it appears the bankruptcy was filed to gain an unfair advantage in litigation or to avoid a regulatory scheme. The ruling leaves the NRA registered in New York, facing a lawsuit from the state's attorney general, which alleges financial abuses by its top leaders, with the goal of putting the NRA out of business. The group's embattled top executive, Wayne LaPierre, says he's disappointed by the ruling, but vows to continue fighting for gun owners' rights. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Brazil's federal government nationally suspended the vaccination of pregnant women with the AstraZeneca COVID-19 shot after an expectant mother in Rio de Janeiro died from a stroke possibly related to the inoculation. The coordinator of the health ministry's vaccination program told reporters the suspension was enacted as a precautionary measure after health regulators issued a warning about the vaccine's use in the pregnant women earlier. Authorities are investigating the incident. The suspicion applies only to AstraZeneca's shot and not the vaccines developed by Sinovac and Pfizer that are also being used in the country. The pregnant woman in Rio de Janeiro died after receiving the AstraZeneca shot, according to the state health secretary. There is more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is the sixth inauguration of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni.
Today, the Chairman Electoral Commission is going to formally present this new president-elect that was elected on 14th January to the nation. Very important day for Ugandans who stand for democracy, for Ugandans who stand for peace and stability.
Ugandan security forces deploy ahead of today's inauguration. Sudan investigates top military chiefs over deadly 2019 crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. Somalia administers COVID-19 vaccines. And Cameroon's military says separatists are resorting to using improvised explosive devices.
Some of us have amputated hands and legs. We have now become beggars. We can no longer take care of our families because of these bombs. So we are begging that whoever is doing it should stop.
And focusing on African literature in the Anglophone world. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni will be sworn in today, Wednesday, for his sixth term, spanning more than three decades. He was declared winner of the January 2021 elections with 58% of the votes, defeating Member of Parliament Robert Chakulahin, also known as Bobby Wine. Several African presidents, including Ramaphosa of South Africa, Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe, and Mohamed of Somalia, are in the Ugandan capital for the ceremonies. Brigadier General Flavia Biakwaso is Army spokesperson and assistant master of ceremony for today's inauguration. She says among President Museveni's many achievements is peace and stability for Uganda, although many of Mr. Museveni's critics say such peace was achieved at the expense of the opposition.
You know, in January 14th, Ugandans went to the poll to elect a new president as mandated by the constitution, and one of the presidents was declared the winner or polled the biggest majority of votes out of the 11. And that president is none other than President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni. So today, the Chairman Electoral Commission is going to formally present this new president-elect that was elected on 14th January to the nation. Very important day in Uganda. Very important day for Ugandans who are peace lovers, for Ugandans who stand for democracy, for Ugandans who stand for development, for Ugandans who stand for peace and stability.
I'm sure you must have been involved in other inaugurations. This one will be the sixth inauguration for President Museveni. How is it different from the previous ones?
The biggest difference comes in a perspective of the COVID-19. Because like you're saying today, you had the whole country converging in Kololo to witness. But this time around, we're just having a handful of people and a few invited guests. We are restricting the number, but we shall have a good number of people present. The rest of the country will be watching this very important event on their TVs.
Brigadier General, of course, you know there have been some security activities. Some members of the opposition have been complaining that their residences have been blockaded by security forces. Any comment on that?
I've not heard anyone had been blockaded, but what I know, what I've heard is there were some deployments around premises on presidential candidates. And you know, these are no longer common people. So anything that may jeopardize their lives or anything that concerns their security becomes a concern for security forces.
As we said, this is the sixth inauguration for President Museveni. Some Ugandans will may be wondering, okay, what did President Museveni do for the people of Uganda during these years?
President Museveni has done lots and lots of things for Ugandans. I'll begin with where we are, peace and stability. For the first time in so many years, you have the country being secure with total peace and stability in all the corners. Whatever you want to mention cannot be possible unless you have peace and stability. And because of these two pillars, everything else is in place. If I take you to the economy, those ones who were here in 1986 will tell you that year, for example, you had an economy that was worth a billion of shillings, perhaps a year it was 14 billion or so. Today you're talking of trillions. Without going into further details, that is already what President Museveni has done to Uganda.
You mentioned that one thing that President Museveni has done is to bring about security. So what would you say to those who might say that the security you talk about was obtained at the expense of some Ugandans?
Let me tell you, there's a saying here in our one of the vernacular in our languages which says that you buy the country by dead bodies. There is no such security that you're going to achieve, you know, without somehow necessarily without having some people being affected. And that begins with the forces themselves. Because when you create order, there are people who are interested in disorder, for example. Whether they like it from to look at it from whatever angle you want to look at it, but the point is a matter of fact that President Museveni has handed Ugandans what is most crucial for their lives to change, and that is peace and stability.
Brigadier General, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Brigadier General Flavia Biokwaso is Army spokesperson and the assistant master of ceremony for today's inauguration. She was speaking with us from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Ugandan security operations have ramped up around the capital ahead of Wednesday's inauguration of President Yoweri Museveni. That includes tight security around the home of opposition leader Bobi Wine, who accused the government of fraud in the January election. As Halima Afumani reports from Kampala, the security measures seem to be a warning to the opposition from authorities.
It's a beehive of activity for security personnel ahead of Wednesday's swearing-in ceremony for President Yoweri Museveni. Kampala streets are guarded by foot patrols of soldiers, rooftop snipers, artillery pieces, armored vehicles, and riot police. Authorities are also intent on containing opposition leader Robert Chagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine. Joel Senyonyi, the National Unity Platform Party spokesperson, says Wine's house has been heavily surrounded by security.
In fact, today they deployed some more. We don't know whether their intention is to hold him under house arrest. The Honorable Chagulanyi has not written to them to ask for security. Today, we sat up at headquarters in Kamocha. The military sent the war tankers. But for us, all this is panic. Panic by Mr. Museveni and his regime because they're afraid of Ugandans simply because they know they stole the victory of Ugandans.
Kano Dewa Kiki, the deputy army spokesperson, says the security at Wine's home is because of his status in the country. Police spokesperson Fred Enanga says officials have intelligence that Wine was planning a parallel inauguration ceremony.
We're already aware of plans by one of the former presidential candidates who lost the recent presidential election and is having plans of holding a parallel and a legitimate swearing-in ceremony in one of the hotels in Iganga. We want to remind him and his supporters that the voices of the electorate were clearly heard.
President Museveni and his National Resistance Movement Party were declared the winner of the January 14th elections with 58.6% of the vote. Wine and his National Unity Platform, which came in second with 34%, said the vote was rigged. While ordinary Ugandans are continuing their normal business, 55-year-old Henry Chisule, a casual laborer moving on his bicycle, says there's nothing exciting about the inauguration. He says when Museveni took power in 1986, he was completing his primary education. He has now lived under Museveni for 35 years and says it is time for change. He says the years he's been in power are so many. Do we want to see him collapse? He says he should have ended with the fifth term. And even the little happiness that we had, because the children he would have propelled into power, he's just torturing them. He says things aren't good. We are not happy. According to the State House, six African presidents have confirmed they will attend the inauguration, while another six will be represented. Despite the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, more than 4,000 guests are expected to gather for the outdoor ceremony. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Sudanese investigators this month questioned top military chiefs on the ruling Sovereign Council over the deadly June 2019 crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. They included head of the controversial Rapid Support Forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who rights groups blamed for the violent dispersal that left more than 120 people dead. But as Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum, rights defenders and relatives of victims doubt he will face justice.
Those being investigated, including the head of the ruling Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the head of the controversial Rapid Support Forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who rights groups blame for the violent dispersal that left more than 120 people dead. A special investigations committee was formed in October 2019, and 3,000 witnesses provided testimony to the committee. In a televised interview, the chief of the committee, Nabil Adib, confirmed the investigations with the military generals. Adib says they summoned anyone they thought is relevant or has information to provide. No one objected it, and they were not prevented from summoning any person with no exceptions. The crackdown took place on June 3, 2019, when security forces attacked and dispersed thousands of pro-democracy protesters in Khartoum. In June 2019, a spokesman for then-ruling military junta, General Shamsuddin al-Kabashi, admitted on national television that generals planned the dispersal. Kabashi says they called for a meeting that was attended by all of the transitional military council and the chief of security forces and took advice from the legal apparatuses to deal with the sit-in. We then directed the military leaders to plan the dispersal of the sit-in. They put their plan and executed it. And then what happened has already happened. We are sorry about it. There were some mistakes and committing of abuses. Al-Kabashi now says he misspoke that day. Kabashi says he mentioned the dispersal of the sit-in in his previous statements, but what he said was taken out of context. In April 2021, a group known as the Families of the December Revolution Victims asked the International Criminal Court to investigate the dispersal for possible crimes against humanity. This is Farah Abbas, a father of a victim and the chief of the organization. Abbas says he expects the committee of the sit-in dispersal will say what happened cannot be changed, as the military leader said. The case's files are in front of the ICC, and the ICC is completing the gaps and defects in the local justice system and courts, when there is no willingness to achieve justice and when there is an absence of law. Relatives of victims like Iman Ismail, a mother of a June 3rd crackdown victim, doubt any of the military generals will face justice. She says there is a sluggishness about the procedures of the Abin cases regarding the victims, and that refers to the unqualified and non-transparent justice system. The sit-in dispersal committee isn't useful and is unnecessary as the evidence is abundant. Truth requires courage from the killers to admit to the Sudanese people that they committed violence and let people decide the path of justice. The families of the victims called for a gathering around the military headquarters in Khartoum Tuesday, but the Sudanese military blocked access with barricades and heavy vehicles. Naba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mpati in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 12. Somalia has been administering COVID-19 vaccines, as we hear in this report from Mohamed Kahir in Mogadishu.
130,000 Somalis have taken the vaccine since the World Health Organization shipped the doses in March. The vaccination exercise slowed down significantly in the last month, says Dr. Oba Farah, the Director of Family Health at Health and Social Service Ministry.
We saw a reduction of vaccine uptake in the middle of April, and in coincidence, Ramadan, this was the main reason. The other myths are about the clothing, especially in European countries, they stopped using the myth that Somali people believe that the vaccine can cause infertility.
The government has embarked on an awareness campaign to utilize the remaining vaccine doses before they expire in 2 months. Farah says the Minister of Health will use all available opportunities to meet the target.
there's a campaign ongoing till the rollout of vaccine in March. We utilize it, all the channels, possible channels, TV, radio, social media, and bodies around the city. We use it, and our health staffs, our actors in the country, and our Islamic advisory group. And above all, we use female health workers who go door by door informing all the people the importance of taking vaccine.
Somalia has a weak healthcare system made worse by the long periods of instability in the country. The Horn of African nation, however, has tried to contain the coronavirus since the first case was recorded in mid-March of last year. Islamic scholars have unanimously agreed that receiving the vaccines during Ramadan for medical purpose does not affect religious obligations. Sheikh Abdul Hayy Sheikh Adam explains. He says the scholars have agreed that the COVID-19 vaccines or any other injection during the holy month of Ramadan performed through the veins or joints will not nullify the fast. He said the medicine must not directly go to the stomach. COVID-19 is a disease caused by the coronavirus. Dr. Abdinasir Ibrahim Mahmoud is the director of the National Call Center for COVID-19 in Mogadishu. Mahmoud says the center has received 18,000 calls each day in the past 2 months. He says they offer hospital referrals for callers with severe symptoms related to the virus. He says call centers also boost the awareness campaign on the significance of taking the vaccine. So far, Somalia has recorded more than 740 fatalities related to the infection, according to the Ministry of Health. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Cameroon authorities say Anglophone separatists have been increasing their use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, which killed 24 people in the past 2 weeks. Cameroon's military held an emergency meeting on the issue on Monday, as Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's Defense Minister Joseph Betty Asomo held 2 emergency meetings in the past week over the increasing use of improvised explosive devices in the country's west. After the meeting on Monday, Asomo said IEDs planted by Anglophone separatists were resulting in almost daily casualties.
De nombreuses opérations de destruction des camps rebelles ont été engagées.
He says as the number of separatist fighters is reducing, the few groups of rebels remaining have resorted to IEDs to fight government troops. Asomo says the military has destroyed many separatist camps, weapons and fighters, while some have surrendered. He says the military seizes or destroys IEDs on a daily basis, adding that Cameroon's troops will never stop protecting civilians. Anglophone rebels on social media posts deny that their numbers are dropping and say the IEDs are targeted at the military to chase them from the western regions. But Asomo said at least 24 troops and civilians were killed by IEDs within the past 2 weeks. 24-year-old University of Yaoundé student Chris Vela says the public bus he was riding Sunday from the northwestern town of Ndop to Yaoundé hit an IED. Vela says 3 passengers died on the spot, while he and 4 others were severely injured.
Some of us have amputated hands and legs. We have now become beggars. We can no longer take care of our families because of these bombs. So we are begging that whoever is doing it should stop. We have suffered a lot because of this crisis. We don't longer want to be victim of this useless conflict.
Cameroon's military confirmed the Sunday bombing took place near Sabga village and said troops detonated 4 other IEDs in the area. Separatists via WhatsApp and Facebook claimed responsibility for the attack, but said it was targeted at the military. Cameroon's rights group activist Clifford Akomoni condemned the rebels' use of IEDs on roads used by civilians.
It is a strategy used by separatist fighters to oust the military from the territory which they claim to be theirs, but their method is disturbing the civilians. Many people abandon their properties just because the area is becoming uncomfortable for them.
Defense Minister Asomo on Monday said Cameroon is deploying special troops to the western regions to detect and destroy IEDs. Cameroon's Anglophone separatists have been fighting since 2017 to create an English state from the French-speaking majority country. Rights groups have blamed both the rebels and government troops for atrocities, including against civilians. The UN says the conflict has left more than 3,000 people dead and 600,000 displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Publishing structures often worked against African literature in the Anglophone world, where sometimes publishers get hung up on one or two authors. This means readers often miss out on local talent and emerging voices, says Bhakti Singapore, co-founder of Warscapes magazine and the Radical Book Collective. Singapore spoke to Ricky Stryak about the new collective and the first two authors, one from Cameroon and the other from Mauritania, that she has started.
I think a radical book needs to kind of be somewhat transformative, by which I mean after reading it, you suddenly become aware of something you might have been taking for granted or you didn't know at all. I think a radical book should have a political, progressive political ideology. It kind of embraces, by that very definition, these are not books that are kind of genre books, right? These are not romances or thrillers and so on, but these are books that can, you know, somehow alter your understanding of the world, give you a language to combat things that are going on in the world. My co-founder, Suchitra Vijayan, did a wonderful video, and she spoke about being a very young person when 9/11 happened. And then in the aftermath, the war on terror was going on, and there were so many crazy things happening, so many injustices, and that reading radical books gave her the tools, gave her the language to understand what was going on in the world.
Let's take Mauritania, for example, just since the second book takes place there and the author is from there. What is the role of radical books or an online book club in shaping new conversations in a place like Mauritania, let's say?
We chose Mohamedou Slahi's work because he personally is very well known, but he is well known for having been incarcerated and tortured at Guantanamo. He was there for many years, and he ended up writing a diary, which has also become a feature film. So that is a very famous part of his life. But we want to focus on this small, beautiful piece of fiction that he wrote. You know, the idea came to him while he was still in Guantanamo, in the prison. And what it does is that, first of all, we have no idea of what is Mauritanian lit, what are those people thinking, what, you know, what is the life like. And this is a book about a camel herder and two camels, Ahmed and Zarga, and it really is a kind of poetic evocation of Bedouin life. Because of its investment in nature and the very epic and intense nature of the desert and the way it kind of seeps into the life of everybody in Mauritania, I think it's also addressing actually climate change, but it's not in in an on-the-nose, very direct way.
The first book you're speaking about is a book, Shades of Black by Natalie Etoke. Why did you choose this as the first book for you guys to speak about?
This book very directly thinks about the uprising for Black lives. In the event of the murder of George Floyd, I think the world has erupted in anger at police, at racism, at the ways in which Black lives are violated. And Natalie Etoke is doing something very interesting, which is that she is of Cameroonian origin. And so she's connecting the struggles of Black people in sub-Saharan Africa with those in the United States and in the West more broadly. And I think this is something we are not seeing enough of. The conversation becomes very U.S.-centric sometimes.
That was Bhakti Singapore, associate professor at the University of Connecticut and co-founder of Radical Book Collective. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi. And that's it for this Wednesday, May 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm Jens Butt in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.
I'm Kim Lewis, your moderator for Issues in the News. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the latest top stories of the week, including U.S. regulators authorized the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to be used by children as young as 12 years of age, widening the pool of those eligible to get inoculated. Listen to Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.